Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman. Coming up this week, the Bristol Energy Co-op. I interview Bernard and we find out about a share scheme. How to stop your doctor from killing you. Useful information. What is celiac disease? We interview Alex Stanley and she's coming up later on to tell us about that. We also go back to the Wiltshire Sound BBC days of Tony Gosling in the 90s and we hear a feature about a dowser, Don Reeves, and he found some water, as he claimed successfully. We also hear another episode of Lady Stanhope's Diary. She goes to Damascus. We also have a double-barreled dose of poetry for you, courtesy of Rosemary Dunn and Stefan Mohammed. We don't have any What Song Guide, sadly, or Song of the Week from Jeff. He's away, but we wish him well, and we hope he'll come back next week. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast on BCFM 93.2. Hello to all our listeners also on Swindon, on Swindon FM, and on Preston FM up in the north, and also in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in and you're in the Bristol area, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square, and you can look them up on the internet as well. Or indeed, in fact, if you want to volunteer and send in features and you live elsewhere in the country, then, you know, feel free to get in touch with Volunteering Bristol as well. I'm sure we can accept MP3s from all around the country if you want to send in a feature. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline. It's aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. I'd like to welcome Bernard into the studio from the Bristol Energy Co-op. Hello.
Hi, nice to meet you all, and thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So tell me a little bit about the Bristol Energy Co-op and how long has this been going on?
Okay, so the Bristol Energy Co-op is all about bringing sustainable energy to Bristol's communities. If I were to summarise it in three values, I'd say it's making green energy owned by the community. It's bringing renewable energy to Bristol and growing our supply of green energy. And it's all about bringing the benefits of green energy to the community.
Okay, and how are you funded?
We're a community investment company, so all our funding comes from either grants that we've had in the past, such as the Community Energy Catalyst Fund, which got us going. And at the moment, we've got a share offer. So we're inviting the people of Bristol to invest in the Bristol Energy Cooperative. And with their investment, we'll use that money to finance our projects.
Okay, so what sort of projects have you got on the go? Whereabouts are we talking in Bristol?
The Bristol Energy Co-op has got two projects going on. One of them is on Hamilton House, which is a community centre in Stokescroft.
Okay, yeah, many people will know that as the canteen.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. One of the projects we got is there's solar panels on top of Hamilton House, which is powering the community centre. And the co-op is just about to, with the money we've got from the investment scheme, to buy some of the panels on there.
Okay.
And also we've got another project in Norwest Media Centre.
Okay.
Which, as the name suggests, is in Norwest, which does a similar thing to Hamilton House and Coexist. And again, we're installing about 19 kilowatts of solar panels on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the energy, again, will power Norwest Media Centre. And we're raising funds from this investment scheme, which I mentioned.
Okay, so is there sort of like a return on that investment?
Yeah, there is. We project about a 4% return on the investment. And to put that into perspective, that's about, well, it's a bit more than most ICES will give you. But the real, at the heart of what the cooperative is doing, is not just about the financial gain, it's about bringing green energy into Bristol. So we're inviting anyone who's over 16 in Bristol to give us an investment, either £50 or, if you've got enough cash, £20,000.
Yeah.
And with that money, we'll finance installing the solar panels on these community buildings.
Okay, so you're sort of running solely on investments at the moment. I imagine with all the austerity cuts, there's probably not many grants available for you.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is quite difficult to get grants because you've got so many community projects out there, so many people vying for the same funding. There's something called the feed-in tariff, which is the government's incentive for solar panels. Every unit of energy you generate with the solar panels, the government will pay you a fixed amount for that.
Yeah.
So when the co-op installs the solar panels, we'll get the return from that, which we can invest in future projects.
Okay. So what's happening to the tariff lately? Is it sort of going down, we assume?
That's a really good question. And some people might have heard it has been slashed. In December, it was about 30p. It's gone down to 15p, and in June it's going down even further.
Okay, so what's actually happening to the costs of solar energy? I mean, is it quite expensive?
Well, that's where the feed-in tariff comes in, because initially, yeah, there is quite a high upfront cost. For example, to install the solar panels on Hamilton House, we've had to raise about £50,000. But that's the good thing about the feed-in tariff, because over the lifetime of the solar panels, you'll pay back the costs, upfront costs, and also you'll get a return, a profit on that, which you can, the co-op is going to reinvest in other projects in the future.
So is that a guaranteed?
Yeah, that's a good question. For 25 years, the government will guarantee payment of that feed-in tariff.
Okay. So what other places are you looking to invest this in? I mean, how ambitious are you?
Really, anywhere in Bristol. Any community organisation that would like solar panels on its roof and is interested in this would really like you to come forward. And if you email us at info@bristolenergy.coop, we'd love to hear from you. There's one restriction. The community centre will need what's called an EPC rating of D, which there's a lot of jargon there, but basically that means you need to have a certain amount of efficiency for how well the building retains heat and energy.
Okay, I see.
But really, anywhere in Bristol, I mean, any community organisation, and we're even thinking about doing it domestically as well. So installing either solar panels or other renewable technologies domestically. So please do get in contact with us if you want to do that.
Okay. I kind of vaguely remember interviewing somebody previously on this show. Is there more than one sort of Bristol-based green energy co-op?
Yes.
Are there quite a few of you dotted around?
I only can think of one of them, the Bristol Power co-op. And they've, on top of Hamilton House, there's 40 kilowatts of solar panels.
Mm.
The Bristol Energy co-op is planning to buy 20 kilowatts of those, and the other 20 kilowatts are bought by the Bristol Power Co-op. So we're doing similar kind of work. So hopefully our work will see the rise of other community cooperatives as well. So,
okay, so there's a bit of green energy competition going on with you all getting in there to get more green energy, competing against each other. Is that sort of what it's like? A bit of friendly competition?
I'm not sure competition is the word, because I mean, we're not exactly rivals. We've got the same objectives at our heart. Bringing energy into community ownership, really, is a case of the more the merrier.
So how many of you are there in the Bristol Energy Co-op in the team?
The Bristol Energy Co-op was founded by some... It was basically a couple of guys chatting in a pub, and they thought, isn't this a good way to bring sustainable energy into Bristol? And from there, it's expanded to 7 directors, and recently we've had a coordinator coming in to help out with the co-op. And together with volunteers and our partners, be those commercial organisations such as solar panel installers or charitable organisations, we've seen the co-op rise to a group of dedicated individuals, often working in their spare time around full-time jobs to continue with the aims of the co-op.
Okay, but, so they're people with sort of business backgrounds and sort of real-life experiences.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. A lot of the people with the co-op are working in sustainability, either as sustainability advisors or architects who assess the sustainability of buildings. But what I'd like to emphasise is, once you invest in the co-op, you become a member of the co-op.
Yeah.
So you have a say in what projects we invest in the future, who our directors are, how any profits we raise are distributed among the members. So although it's 7 of us at the moment, I would really like to see the cooperative rise. And at the moment, we have 56 investors, so it's onward and upward from here, really.
So do you get to sort of get together on a regular basis and have meetings so that you can all...
We have annual AGMs, so that's our meeting where we can decide who the directors are, what projects we'd like to see in the future, and how the profits we raise from the feed-in tariff will be distributed among the members in our projects.
Okay, so if somebody is sort of interested in this share scheme, I guess, well, let's get down to the money bit. I mean, how the benefits of that share scheme, how often does that sort of return come to you, and on what basis?
Okay, so as I said earlier, we've got a 4% return on your investment, and that will be distributed annually. I will say it's projected, because it's not guaranteed. And if you want to know more about the details, we've got what's called a share offer document, which is basically a guide to everything you need to know to invest. And that's on our website, which is www.bristolenergy.coop. So if you have a look at that guide and read it carefully, and if you would like to invest and you really like what the co-op's doing, there's an application form online as well. And if you send that through to our address, which is in the share offer document, we'll be happy to receive that and welcome to the co-op.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Bernard. And just as a reminder, if people are interested in finding out more, what's the website?
Okay, so the website is www.bristolenergy.coop. And even if you'd like to ring us, it's 07503 372 689, and we'd really like to hear from you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're now joined by Alex Stanley, and you're here to talk about celiac disease, and it's something that you've been kind of diagnosed with fairly recently, but weren't aware that you had for quite a long time.
That's true.
Can you tell us about it?
Well, celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, which means that your body's immune system attacks your own body. And it happens when the person with celiac disease eats gluten, which is the protein which is in wheat, rye, barley and oats.
Quite a lot of stuff then.
Yeah, pretty much everywhere.
Can we just spell celiac? Because I know that a lot of people probably heard of it as a dietary kind of thing, but probably don't necessarily understand the spelling or kind of...
Sure. In Britain, it's spelled C-O-E-L-I-A-C.
So what kind of symptoms were people experiencing with celiac disease?
Well, very classical symptoms would be symptoms that seem to be like irritable bowel syndrome. So diarrhea, wind, bloating, possibly even vomiting or reflux. But then your body, that would be if your body's attacking your gut, but it may be that it's attacking other organs as well. So it could be the brain, in which case the person might be depressed or very irritable, or it could be the nervous system and they could be getting tingling hands, or the pancreas and they could become diabetic.
So that's a huge range of things that people potentially might be experiencing and have no idea that that's celiac disease.
It makes it quite hard to diagnose, yeah.
Okay, well, tell me about kind of your story with it. How did you get diagnosed in the first place?
Well, I was ill for a lot of my life with different things. I had a lot of sore throats and ulcers in my throat all the time, and I was very, very tired since the time I was a teenager, and I could just fall asleep anywhere, fall asleep on the bus, at work, and I couldn't do as much as other people because I was always tired. And I was also very depressed, but not for any reason. Nothing had happened. I just was. And I used to, you know, cry for no reason and things. And also I was very irritable. And actually, I didn't get a definitive answer from my GP. They just put me on medication. So I tried lots of things. I tried acupuncture and all sorts, looking to feel better. And eventually I saw a nutritionist who said it looks like celiac disease. So I went and got tested, and the test came back positive at the doctor's, and I got a diagnosis.
So what's the kind of provenance of celiac disease? You know, how do you kind of catch it? What, you know, where does it come from?
It's a genetic disease. So if you have the genes, you may never develop the disease, or you can develop the disease at any point in life. The average age to be diagnosed is between 40 and 50 years old. But then a lot of people are ill for a long time before anyone works out what's going on.
So this misdiagnosis is obviously a problem, and there are a lot of people who have no idea that they've potentially got this problem. I mean, how, in terms of raising awareness, you know...
Well, that's true. And actually, approximately 1 in 100 people in the UK have celiac disease, and it affects people of all ethnic groups. They used to think that it only affected children, and that it only affected white people in the north of Europe, but that was because they hadn't tested other people. And only 1 in 8 people with celiac disease have been diagnosed. In a city the size of Bristol, that means there's around 9,000 people walking around who don't know why they're ill. They're celiac, but no one's diagnosed them.
Why do you think that people don't know about it or aren't aware of that it might be potentially kind of the reason they're feeling ill, or kind of if they mention it to their doctor, perhaps the doctors don't have enough training to kind of recognise it? Is there a kind of a problem in that respect?
Yeah, it's because research is moving so fast. So when a lot of our doctors were at medical school, they would have been taught it was a rare childhood illness. And it's really in the last sort of 10 years that research is exploding, and they're saying, okay, this could be causing depression, this can cause diabetes, it can cause ADHD.
So what should people do if they kind of want to challenge their doctor? What would you kind of advise in terms of, I think I might be have celiac disease, what should I do about it?
Well, the NHS have actually changed their guidelines, their NICE guidelines, which you can look at on the internet. And your doctor should actually offer you a test if you have any of the symptoms which are now recognised, sort of IBS symptoms, recurrent mouth ulcers, a member of your family with celiac disease. So you can ask your doctor for a test. You can also contact Celiac UK, which is the UK charity for people with celiac disease. If you look on their website, they've got a helpline which anyone can call and they'll give you some advice.
How do you feel now that you kind of have an answer for what was kind of plaguing you for such a long time?
Well, it's great because now I'm healthy and I've got lots more energy than I've ever had and I'm not ill all the time. So it's wonderful. But obviously I feel quite angry that I was ill so long when I didn't need to be. And that's really why I wanted to come in today.
You purely thought that was kind of down to the fact that the GPs probably didn't have a good understanding of what potentially your issue might have been?
Yes, and I think it wasn't their fault because they didn't know.
Is there kind of, with the whole genetic kind of side of things as well, you know, in terms of your family and the impact, obviously, of your illness, but equally, you know, in terms of their predisposition for having celiac disease as well? I mean, how's that kind of affected you? Do anyone in your family kind of have celiac disease as well?
Yes. When I got diagnosed, all my immediate family members had to be tested. And in fact, two of them came back positive. So they are also on a gluten-free diet now. And they're also feeling much better than they felt for years. And I should also add that some people with celiac disease have no symptoms at all. So they often just find out by chance if a family member gets diagnosed and they get tested, and they still have to go on a gluten-free diet because otherwise their body will be silently attacking itself and this could cause them a lot of problems later on.
So what's the kind of day-to-day kind of life of a celiac? What kind of things can't you eat? And do you find it hard to kind of find products, I suppose, that are suited to you?
Well, I mean, there are some obvious things like bread and pasta and biscuits, but you can buy all of those in gluten-free versions. And then there are things that are more complicated, like sauces and excipients in medicines, and then you have to check labels very carefully and sometimes call manufacturers.
I mean, do you find as well those kind of things tend to be more expensive as well?
Yes, they are expensive, but if you're diagnosed celiac in the UK in this area, in this part of the country, you get some gluten-free food on prescription every month.
Oh, okay. So in terms of like other kind of support measures like that, in terms of charitable organizations and kind of people who can help in that respect, obviously getting stuff on prescription is fantastic, you know, are there other things available for people?
Well, Celiac UK are really good and they'll give you a lot of support and information, and they're working actively with the NHS to improve diagnosis rates and to support people better with celiac disease, and your doctor will also refer you to a dietitian.
Did you find, obviously you spoke to a nutritionist about kind of, that was kind of your last chance saloon, I suppose. Is that something else that you would kind of recommend that somebody do? What's the kind of difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist?
A dietitian is NHS registered, working within a particular framework. And a nutritionist, actually, I don't really want to go into that. Do you mind if I don't?
No, that's fine. We'll just cut it.
Because it's so controversial.
Oh, really?
And okay. Actually, it was because...
There was something else you wanted to mention as well about people who don't get diagnosed as being as having celiac disease, but equally feel that they have it. What are those people kind of suffering from?
Well, recently there's been a new condition called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which has been recognised by researchers, which is when somebody's medical antibody tests come back negative, but in fact the person's ill and they get better when they don't eat gluten. So up until now, you know, a lot of people have been in a really difficult position dealing with that without any medical support. But this is now starting to be recognised as a condition, and it appears it doesn't have the genetic element either. And Celiac UK can also support people and give people advice if they don't have a medical diagnosis.
Fantastic. Do you know the Celiac UK kind of website or kind of contact details?
If you Google Celiac UK,
It's all there. Great. Well, thank you very much for helping us kind of raise awareness of celiac disease and kind of hopefully helping some people understand a bit more about it, and also going to speak to their doctor about it if they're worried. So
yeah, and can I also add, it's really important not to go on a gluten-free diet unless you've had your test first, unless you've been tested by your doctor.
Is there a specific reason for that?
Yes, because if you're not eating gluten, then your body won't be attacking itself, then your tests will come back negative. And if you go to the doctor and say you want a test, they're going to tell you that you need to eat it for 6 weeks before the test. And if you've already given it up and you do have celiac disease, it can be extremely, extremely unpleasant to start eating it again. So then you'll get stuck without a diagnosis.
That's okay. That's very worrying. Okay. Thank you for making us aware of that. Alex Stanley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just to help those people out trying to spell celiac in Google search box, could you just let us know how the spelling goes again?
Sure. In Britain, it's spelt C-O-E-L-I-A-C.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page, who's recently returned from a fact-finding trip to Albania. For 40 years up until 1985, the country was ruled by Enzo Hoxha, the dictator. All the borders were closed, and the whole country was surrounded by a 2.6-metre electrified fence. Anybody who tried to escape by sea or land was shot. Those who opposed the regime were sent to prison concentration camps, and they sprung up all over the country. This week's feature is about the media corruption, which is still rife in the country. And to start, we hear some music, the Dirge of Permit, some regional music from the south of Albania.
Anderson, St. Paul, Minnesota.
And you work for the television channel in Tirana, Albania.
Yes, that's one of my jobs, Ora News. I do the English language news at 6 o'clock.
Can you tell us what you think about the politics over here?
Well, if you're familiar with the old Marx Brothers duck soup and the nation of Fredonia, you have the politicians here in Albania and the politics of Albania and the frustrations of Albania. A place that doesn't work, a place that with crazy leaders that, you know, just hate each other. Is he really a socialist, or does he just hate the other guy? You have with the corruption. So the politics here is pretty bad. It's not a good thing. It's not a positive thing. It's something, in fact, to be very worried about. If they don't change in the next 5-10 years, they've got problems. Berisha wants to be in power. He wants to win the re-election. Rama is no better. Ilir Meta is, no better. Maybe the new political party with the president, Bamir Topi, and some of the conservatives, some of the Democrat Party, Berisha's group, leaving Berisha and joining Topi, that might be a good thing.
You've been here since 2008. What changes have you seen since that time?
There's changes in services, less electrical cuts, less water cuts, or almost none. You've seen buildings going up. You've seen new businesses starting, unfortunately, mainly gambling and coffee houses. That's a big thing, coffee houses. People are industrious. Unfortunately, there's not any industry, but people are industrious, and they're trying to do business. They're trying to open businesses to make more money. Fortunately, the people haven't changed in the sense that they're still very nice. They're great, very welcoming and friendly to foreigners, love Americans. They are very honest. Shopkeepers and that will come racing after you because you paid 50 cents too much. So that is a good thing. The worry is the politics and the politicians, the future of Albania. If they don't change in the next 5 or 10 years, I think that you're going to see an Albania that goes the way of Greece or worse. I really think 10 years, 15 years, you could see a Balkans in flames again. We have averted our eyes. We think everything's taken care of here, and it is not. You have former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which is a state in somebody's dreams. It's not a real country. There's no such thing as Macedonians unless they're Greek. They're either Slavs or they're Albanians, and they're Christian and they're Muslim, and they just don't get along together. They want to kill each other. They say horrible things about each other. There's no unity. They're not a nation. They're not a nation united in people. They don't have a common history. You have difficulties in Kosovo with the Serb minority and the Albanians. In fact, I've heard Albanians here describe the Kosovo Albanians as a little bit more radical, a little bit crazier. They should be able to get along with the Serbs. They should be able to get along with the Christians, the way it's done here in Albania, the way the history of Albania is. And that's one of the great things about Albania, and perhaps something not known by most people, is that whereas in the rest of the Balkans you have people killing each other because they're Muslim or they're Christian or they're Orthodox or, you know, what type of Christian, what type of Muslim, and they kill each other. Here in Albania, as far as I can tell, that never happened. In fact, quite the opposite. They celebrate each other's religion. They join together to celebrate each other's holidays. When there's a holiday, everybody gets out. Just because it's Christmas, not just the Christians leave the school, everybody has school off. Same with the end of Ramadan. People are, the word is besa, and it showed itself in World War II. The one nation on earth, the one nation certainly in Europe, all of Europe, where if you were Jewish and you made it here, you were safe. England, of course, but how to get to England? Here, you were safe. And it wasn't a government that said, we'll protect you. It wasn't a government in exile that said, protect these people. It wasn't a king that said, protect these people. It wasn't the partisan leader Hoxha or any of the other partisans saying, protect these people. It was the individual Albanian family or leader of a family that said, here are people in need, here are people that are being hunted down to be killed, and we're not, it's just not right. We're not going to let that happen. Whole Jewish families would be safe in an Albanian family's house. It's the only nation in at least continental Europe where there were more Jews at the end of the war than there were at the beginning of the war. And that just says something about the people, and that's why I think Albania is special and why these next 5-10 years are crucial, because I don't believe that it's good for Albania to be part of the European Union. I don't think that would be a good thing. All you have to do is look at Greece. I don't think the European Union really wants Albania or the Balkans in. Now, why would they if, you know, look what happened, again, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, the fun they're having with those two countries. So somehow Albania has to make its mark on its own. It has to, there needs to be an Albanian spring. Young people, more open-minded politicians, and I've met a couple of them that understand about the corruption and things like that, need to get the ability to have power and to get in charge. The problem is you have a constitution that's so whacked out and weird, and that it allows this bit virtual dictatorship of whoever's the prime minister. You know, who's going to be president? How are they going to choose who's going to be president? How are they going to agree on that person? According to the EU, it has to be a consensus choice. Well, just because they are what they are. If one said Jesus Christ and the other said Muhammad, they'd both say no to both of them. Mother Teresa couldn't be picked. If one supported it, the other would say she's the devil reincarnated. It doesn't matter. So somehow there has to be an awakening here. There has to be an understanding that they have something special here. This is a great country. They have something special. They have hydroelectric power. They have solar power. They have wind energy. They have geothermal. They have all the water they need. They have all the land they need to produce food organically. They have everything that Europe, they have the people that are hungry for jobs and that had industry before until the communism ended, and then people destroyed all the industries. They could be a small little powerhouse in the Balkans, and they could provide the rest of the Balkan nations, especially Kosovo, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, vision of what to, if we're like this, then we can also gain these benefits and make the Balkans peaceful rather than the possible powder keg that I think it will become in 10, 15 years if there's not changes.
My name is Kerdip, and I am Vice General Manager of Top Channel, that is the biggest commercial TV on Albania. Top Channel is operating in Albania 10 years now. It's General TV that produces news entertainment and hard talks, every program that is needed for our market. So Top Channel is covering Albania with Signal, is covering in Kosovo, and is covering in Montenegro over satellite. So all cable in Balkan area or abroad in UK or in Italy or in Germany. So with this they can receive Top Channel.
Do you cover most of the main news stories on your channel?
Yeah, sure. We cover all main news stories. We have a big news department. We have around 7 news broadcasts a day, and we have investigation news every day from Monday to Friday. We uncover corruption. We have seen fell down of prime minister on corruption case or minister on sex scandal abuse. So we have been top investigation news on our channel.
How keen are politicians to share their views about their politics on television?
We have one main hard talk political talk shows, and there are 2 other shows. There are different themes. There are more light shows when people can discuss their opinion and share their view about their political view.
You mentioned that you expose corruption in the government. Does this have any comeback on the journalists?
There is a comeback in the Top Channel, because the Top Channel is the company that is covering everything. It's not going directly to journalists, but it's coming directly to the company. So there are a lot of problems that government created to Top Channel. There's a lot of attack, cutting the contract that we had for the premises or renting premises, sending us in court and creating a lot of problems in the court. For example, one of the ministers that we sent to the court rules that we have to pay 100,000 euros a fine because we uncovered the story. And there are a lot of other pressure that come directly or indirectly from government.
Does it make it easier to expose the corruption then if they realise that you're not going to give way to the attack?
Top Channel, this is the last chance for them to protect themselves from corruption cases or from unfair that can happen on everyday life. Every day you can see people that come, bring here documents, say their cases against the corruption or the case.
So is this helping to clean the country up, do you think?
We try to do our part, so the voice of people can be heard from everybody.
And you mentioned that you have live television in Parliament.
When is the parliamentary session, we cover them live TV on our 24-hour news channel, so we cover all topics that are discussion over there.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page, who's talking about the media and the corruption which is still going on in Albania. Briefly, for the geographically befuddled, that is south of the former Yugoslavia, the capital of which is Tirana. Time to jump in the radio TARDIS and go back 20 years to when Tony Gosling used to work for BBC Wiltshire Sound. And here's a little gem he dug up. The reporter in this is Julie Newing, and it's a story about a dowser who did, in fact, manage to find some water, exactly as he promised.
I found the pipe, glazed pipe. Now I'm going to try and find if there's any oil by holding oil in my hand. And the stick, fork stick, will go neutral. He won't move at all. If it's not oil, he will dip.
73-year-old Don Rees from Causley near Warminster has been dowsing since he was 17. He's practiced dowsing for a living, working for a borehole firm, and he's also been called in to help find missing people, using what he calls his electrical powers. He offered to help out after reading about the oil slick at Sherrington and quickly established exactly where the oil was coming from.
There you are. And then we go over. He's neutral. He doesn't dip at all. So that shows me it's oil in there. If I put anything else in my hand, the stick will dip.
Can you show us exactly where it is?
Well, just here. Yeah, just right there. There's the pipe and there's the oil where I got it in my hand.
And that's where the oil's leaking from?
Yeah.
And that's what you've offered to tell the Rivers Authority?
Yes.
What did they actually say to you when you offered to tell them?
Well, they wanted me to come, but they didn't want to pay me anything for coming.
And how much were you asking for?
Well, I said it was private before, but it was actually £30.
And why do you think they won't pay you the money?
Well, probably they're hard up or don't believe me.
The oil leak at Sherrington's becoming a major headache for the NRA. They've already tried several different methods to find out where the oil's coming from. First, they called in a firm to test the pipework in the area, but no joy. They then used underwater cameras, but that didn't work either. And now they're planning to dig up the road. So far, it's cost them more than £1,000, and they estimate it's going to cost them a lot more than that before they're finished. So why don't they pay Mr. Reeves £30 for his advice? After all, it's a lot cheaper than these other failed methods. Phil Hewitt is their spokesman.
It isn't our practice to have to pay people to tell us what they know. If people know the source of the pollution, usually they come up with the information for us and we're able to follow it through. That seems to be a fairly simple matter, and of course I can't explain why somebody wants to charge us for the information.
But Mr. Reeves has a skill and says he wants to be rewarded for that. Phil Hewitt again.
We don't know that the information he's got is actually any use to us. We don't know if it's accurate. We don't know if it's precise. We don't know how it was obtained. We don't know that, of course, in any case, when people give us information. All I do know is that local people usually give us information, and I don't think we ought to start paying people for that. That's a public service, and people are usually very willing to do it.
Meanwhile, villagers living in Sherrington are getting fed up with the overpowering smell of oil. Jim Green lives right next to a pond fed by the stream, and he says he's had enough of it.
The wind's in this direction, it's all right. But when the wind changes direction and goes down the village, I can't have a window or door open because the smell is so terrific. It's vile because at the moment it's held down because they replenish the stuff in the river, in the water. Replace that to keep the smell down and absorb the oil. Now you've got a smell of it now, haven't you?
Yes.
And it's blown up this way. So reverse that round and have it blown on the front of my house. And you've got the full strength of it.
Don Reeves says he doesn't understand the NRA's attitude. Meanwhile, the road diggers move into Sherrington today and they'll find out one way or another if he was right.
Thank you very much to Julie Newing and Tony Gosling, and indeed the dowser. If he's still out there, he's probably still dowsing to this very day. Time once again for another episode of Lady Stanhope's Travels. It was written by Virginia Charles and it's read by Malcolm Grieve. This week, Lady Hester is in Damascus and she meets the Pasha.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert. In August 1812, when Lady Hester rode unveiled and daring through the city gate, Damascus was a busy, bustling town of about 200,000 to 300,000 people. Lady Hester had been given lodgings in the Christian sector, as was usual for any visiting Europeans. But as Christians and Greeks were so despised, this area of the town was almost like a ghetto, and Lady Hester decided it simply would not do. Hardly had poor Marion recovered from the ordeal of their entrance into the city than he reeled again as Hester sent a quaking dragoman to the Pasha of Damascus with a firm request for relocation to a better part of town. Not knowing who he was taking on, the Pasha turned down the request, but Lady Hester was so persistent that by the end of the same day, the Pasha was forced to relent. The unfortunate dragoman was then conducted from house to house until one was found that suited her ladyship. It was in the best quarter of Damascus, close to both the palace and the bazaars, and it was beautiful. Damascus was architecturally very similar to many other towns in the Levant. Minarets and palm trees towered over the narrow winding streets and jumbled whitewashed houses. Five times a day the call to prayer echoed out over the city, and the loudest noise the muezzin had to contend with was the coughs and grunts of the camels and the bustle and chat of everyday life. But there was an additional and lovely sound in Damascus, that of playing water. Scores of small streams from the River Barada had been diverted to crisscross under and through the town, and these fed the countless gardens that graced the city and the fountains that played in every courtyard and square. In every public place and nearly every private house, the air was cooled and the senses refreshed by running water. Lady Hester's new house was no exception. It opened through a narrow passage into an oblong marble-paved court. In the middle of a court was a large basin shaded by two very lofty lemon trees, into which two brazen serpents poured a constant supply of fresh water, Two large recesses in the courtyard walls allowed for outside seating areas, and twin staircases wound up the outside of the walls to lead to Lady Hester's rooms on one side, and on the other a saloon in which to receive visitors. It seemed that everyone in Damascus wanted to meet Hester. She made one decision almost immediately that guaranteed her favour with the Turks. The superiors of two local monasteries were in the habit of making calls on visiting Europeans, but since she had been granted the concession of living in the Turkish quarter, she requested them not to visit, for fear of offending her Muslim neighbours. Her thoughtfulness was appreciated. She rested for 2 days before venturing out. Word had spread like wildfire through the town that a hugely important and rich foreign lady had arrived. Rumours had sprung up that Lady Hester was English royalty, that she was indeed the daughter of the king. When she finally emerged through the narrow doorway from her house, it was to see a crowd of hundreds who had been patiently waiting for a sight of the great Elendi, or queen. She had decided to make her first excursion around Damascus as she had entered the city, unveiled, and accompanied only by her young interpreter Giorgio and her janissary Mohammed. Although Meriam was getting resigned to her daring escapades by now, he was almost beside himself with worry. He knew that one critical or ribald comment from the crowd might precipitate a riot. He need not have worried. The crowd adored her. They were won over by a grave yet pleasing look, an unembarrassed yet commanding demeanour. Her conduct was so unlike what Muslims had come to expect from a Christian, and so similar to the qualities most admired in Turkish aristocracy, that a new rumour started. It was murmured around the crowd that here was an English queen of Ottoman descent. Was not the instep of her foot as high as an Arab's? Did she not dress as a Turkish ruler? The inconvenient fact that she had a very fair complexion was also explained away. It was paint, they decided, but so skillfully applied as to be undetectable. One important event of these early days in Damascus was, of course, Lady Hester's visit to the Pasha. Not only was it a courtesy on both sides for them to meet, but if Lady Hester were to make an expedition to Palmyra, she would need to enlist the Pasha's help. Said Süleyman Pasha had spent his life at the court of Sultan Selim in Constantinople and was a proud, dignified and very formal Turkish gentleman. When Lady Hester arrived at the palace to meet him, it almost seemed as if he was trying to intimidate her. First, she was escorted through several echoing antechambers lit only by guttering candles, whose uncertain light reflected off the arms of countless soldiers and attendants, who stood lining the route in utter silence. She was then ushered past row upon row of the Pasha's court, who watched her avidly, eager to see the strange English woman who dressed as a man and who had presumed to dictate to their Pasha where she should live. For almost anyone except Lady Hester, it would have been an unnerving experience. The dragoman who accompanied Lady Hester followed her with all the enthusiasm of an aristocrat approaching the guillotine. The Pasha was at the very end of the final room, a small man sitting very straight on a crimson sofa. Unlike many other governors whom Lady Hester had visited, he did not accord her the intimacy of rising when she approached, but merely indicated with a regal wave of his hand where she was to sit. Hester's dragoman was trembling so much by this time that he was quite unable to act as interpreter, and could only stand there stuttering and shaking. Lady Hester was unperturbed by this show of nerves, and waited quietly until the poor man was able to stammer out the mutual salutations. The interview passed off successfully, and although one gathers that Said Süleyman was not quite so entranced with Lady Hester as most other pashas had been, gifts were exchanged, and everyone was satisfied.
Thank you very much to Virginia Charles for writing the book, for Lady Stanhope for existing, otherwise the book wouldn't have been written about her, and also to Malcolm Grieve. I'd like to give a brief apology for Jeff not being here. I'm afraid he's out this week, and we wish him well, and hopefully we will be back in next week. It's time for some poetry, and I'd like to introduce Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there.
How's it going with the poetry? All good?
Yeah, it is. And I'm going to be doing poetry this year at a festival at Hay on Wye called How the Light Gets In.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a largely philosophy-based festival, but it's on at the same time as the literature festival.
Okay.
So I've written a poem about philosophy.
Okay.
Philosophy, it's not an ology. It's not a science, an over-reliance on theosophy, whatever that is. It's not etymology, that's words, nor ornithology, that's birds. It's metaphysics or astronomy. Some would posit it's astrology, though it probably isn't Russell Grant. It's Immanuel Kant. That's a philosopher's joke. A quest for guidance from the stars to seek out who and where we are, or is that cosmology? It's not anatomy, that's body parts, or cardiology, that's the heart. Philosophy includes the arts, the aesthetics, ethics, and parts the other ologies cannot reach. I imagine it's a bugger to teach. It's not tautology. Tautology, it's not. Or thermodynamics, which encapsulates hot. Nor is it mammalians or Scientology aliens. It uses brainography, does philosophy. It was invented by the Greeks long before science fiction geeks. It's the discipline for thinking things differently, is philosophy. It's known to be bold. Even poets get involved, though I've never ever heard it called Byrony. Sometimes there's irony. Still, it doesn't traduce. It's there to deduce. No Deuteronomy, which deals with sin, nor marine biology, that's things what swim, nor phrenology, which is lumps, nor sexology, that's raunchy humps. It's humanology. Whoops, that's anthropology. What it's not is strictly dancing armography. It's that place where humans dream, catch the zeitgeist heady stream. It's the string which binds us in, catch the glimpsed and not the seen. It seeks answers hard to find. Does the body rule the mind, or does the mind rule the body? That's not Bill Oddy, but the Smiths. It questions whether God does exist. So, enjoy philosophy. It's where angels dare to tread, dance a tango on the head of a pin. It's how the light gets in.
Thank you very much. And if there are any genuine philosophers out there, no doubt they'll be able to write incredibly long articles dealing with everything that you've alleged. You can imagine it, can't you? No.
Yes.
Hegelian dialectics says they were completely wrong.
That's my
answer. So when is your festival, briefly?
Oh, yes. It's bank holiday weekend, June bank holiday week, rather. And my bit is the 4th of June, Monday the 4th of June.
Yep.
And I'm on at 1:45 in the pavilion tent.
Okay.
At Hay on Wye.
Rosemary Dunn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce Stefan Mohammed, a poet. Hello.
Hi.
How long have you been a poet?
These poems that I'm doing at the moment, only quite recently. I used to write sort of more traditional page-type poetry, drifted away from it a bit, and then wanted to find a way of having a bit more fun with it. So I decided to try my hand at some of the more performance-type poetry.
Ah, I see. So is this sort of more stuff that you keep in your head and then sort of recite it from memory? Sort of thing?
Yeah, more of that, more stuff that doesn't necessarily work as well written down as it does sort of being said out loud.
Ah, I see. Is that a totally different method inside your head of trying to think of how you're going to put your poems together?
Yeah, it is. It's a lot more about the rhythm and the flow, and I don't use rhyme so much when I'm writing just purely for the page, but these ones I find that using rhyme really helps to get more of a rhythm.
Okay, and what inspirations do you draw from? Are there other performance parts you really like?
I really like John Cooper Clarke.
Yeah.
Benjamin Zephaniah, And I've only recently been getting involved in the performance poetry scene in Bristol, but it's a really, really kind of vibrant and eclectic scene, and there's loads of really, really good poets. So okay. It's been really exciting.
What have we got for us today?
It's a poem called Aria.
Okay. When you're ready.
Okay. I wrote an aria for disenfranchised youth on a cubicle door in a grubby public loo. Isn't that the sort of thing poets do? Scratchy Biro doesn't exactly scream I run things. Perhaps it was deliberately puerile, expressing all that's futile through semi-existential mediocrity. Maybe it's what you read rather than what you see. This rallying cry, in the harsh light of a graffitied stallion's eye, twixt the scrawls of so-and-so likes this and the witless spit of twits who hold their medallions high, revolutionary smoke in the rapscallion sky. A statement of intent, at least to the extent that any intent was meant. Maybe I just decided to give grammar up for Lent. Maybe this pit was the only place for such subversive wit. You can't just poeticise on any old fence. Is it a fence or defence? Her fence or he fence? You fence or me fence? Even this nonsense makes some sense, although it made more sense in the gents. I once wrote a sonnet on a car bonnet. Turns out it was the wrong car, and I got chased by a racist with an iron bar. He didn't realise that Al-Qaeda don't use iambic pentameter. So positioning is key. You need the right person to see such a simultaneously heartening and heartbreaking decree. Maybe I fixed democracy with a rhyme, found a way to reconcile humankind with their generational crimes, found a way through just a few lines to turn back time and find a compromise between the purity of the primordial slime and the design that led to September 1939. Maybe this piece of resplendent art transcended the sum of its parts, and I achieved Zen with a rubbish old pen. Or maybe, in fact, I couldn't think of anything particularly witty or incisive to say, so I left the door blank, zipped up, and went away.
Stefan, thank you very much.
Cheers.
So when do you perform out in public? Will people be able to go out and see?
There is an open mic night called Siren Says, which I believe is every second Tuesday of every month. And that is at the Starbucks on Park Street.
Okay.
And that's a really nice little night. That's the only one I've been to so far, but I'm going to hopefully start hitting up a few more because I think there are quite a lot.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all for this week. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for listening. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers. And we're also broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. We're also broadcast on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam, but also in Swindon on Swindon FM. So if you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or find out more about us from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thank you to our studio guests, Bernard Stricker and Alex Stanley. The reporters this week were Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. And the studio production this week was by Dave Bazanko. Thank you very much for Malcolm Grieve, also for reading another episode of Lady Stanhope. And the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web. Also at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, also, the number for the Bristol Bully Watch helpline is 01454 318 753. Next week, Anthea Page is producing, but that's all for this week. For Dialect, I'm John Peters Common, wishing you a very good week. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Thank you.